Now, this last session, we're talking about the implications of the approaching demographic tidal wave, and actuaries understand that. We want to see where technology and other innovations will likely result in people are living a lot longer than they expect. There are significant issues for member engagement, product and public policy issues emerging in making sure we can be ready for the changes. To discuss these issues, I have a panel of four experts. Each panellist will speak for about 5 to 10 minutes, and then we'll have a panel discussion, just going through some of those issues and having a sort of question answer. If you've got questions, then you can SMS those. And SMS number, has that been up? 0416 907 434, and I'll get those questions up here. So I'll introduce all the panellists now, and then we can kick off. So closest to me, Brian Bissaker. Brian is the CEO of Colonial First State Investment. Brian joined Colonial First State in 2002 and was promoted to Chief Executive Officer in 2006. Prior to joining Colonial First State, Brian spent 8 years at BT's fund management business, where he was an Executive Vice President and Head of Products. He is the Deputy Chairman of the Financial Services Council and co-chairs the FSC Super Committee. Next one along, Tony Lally. Tony is the CEO of Sun Super, and hopefully Tony will tell us a bit about Sun Super when you do your session, and has been there since 2007. He's overseen a number of strategic initiatives, including the acquisition of City Streets Australia, which resulted in insourcing of all administration and member services to the fund. Tony spent 5 years based in Japan with Deutsche Bank and Deloitte, where he developed implemented strategic plans for funds management, actuarial and insurance businesses throughout the Asia Pacific. He was with the Commonwealth Bank for 10 years, where he led Australia's largest retail funds management business. Next one along from Tony is Mark Lieberman. Mark Lieberman is Chief Executive Officer of MetLife Australian business. As CEO, Mark is responsible for all aspects of MetLife Australia's business with a strong focus on driving profitable long-term growth. Mark joined MetLife in 2010, and under his leadership, the focus will be to drive customer service and a value-driven organisation. Mark has 25 years' experience in financial services and extensive experience in delivering high-growth results. And finally, on the end, Richard Howes. Richard Howes is the Chief Executive of Challenger Life. He has overall executive responsibility for the management of Challenger Life, an APRA-regulated life insurance company. Challenger Life is the foremost annuity provider in Australia, with an investment portfolio valued at in excess of $8.25 billion, backing annuity policies held by 60,000 Australian retirees. Richard joined Challenger in 2003 from Zurich Capital. Okay, we've got four people here, and I'll now ask each of them for, say, 5 or so minutes to sort of give an introductory statement on their views of the world and, in particular, demographic trends, and then we'll start a discussion with them. So, Brian, thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Barry. It was a very open brief today to come and talk about retirement generally, and the topic that I chose to discuss is really a reflection upon the success of account-based pensions. As something's dear to my heart, having been at BT in July of 1994 when they launched the first allocated pension, or one of the first allocated pensions, and worked with the account-based pension through time. But there's something very powerful about it, and why I wanted to talk a little bit about it is because I fear that a lot of the debate is moving to a point where we're almost sort of dismissing the benefits of account-based pensions. So I just wanted to draw people's minds back to the benefits and reflect upon what the market is telling us about those products. And to look at what the market is telling us about them, let's look at the stats. Last year, there was, year to December, there was $30 billion of gross new money going into account-based pensions. In the same period, there was just under $2 billion went into annuities. And within that, there was only $27 million went into lifetime annuities. So there's something that the market, the advisors and their clients are telling us about the benefits of account-based pensions. And without spending all afternoon, we just talk about a few of those benefits. In relation to the flexibility that the account-based pension gives to customers, they can structure the assets that they see fit within the wrapper that is an account-based pension. If they want capital surety, they can put term deposits or cap guarantees products within account-based pensions, as well as, importantly, getting access to growth assets. And if we're talking about people outliving their sort of life expectancy, it is important, in my view, to have a proportion in growth assets. You can debate how much, but I think all retirees should have some proportion in growth assets. So the other side of the equation, the account-based pension gives a lot of flexibility around being able to pull money out when they need to fund extra expenses, etc., getting access to growth assets to a certain proportion and the like, and being able to structure their portfolio. But our retirees, we hear a lot about double dipping. We hear a lot about, well, there's people are not going to be able to manage their retirement. We have to do more things for them because they're not doing it prudently. But the latest that I could see on that issue was in the Henry Tax Review, where they went away from compulsion and indeed quoted a study which said that Australian retirees, by and large, are prudently managing their money. And I'll put some statistics around that from what we see at our business. In the account-based pension business, we have $20 billion invested. And each year, between 1% and 2% is the amount that is commuted in addition to income streams being paid out. So there's not a lot of money being frittered away or taken out of the pension, even though they can take the whole lot if they want. But on average, it's only 1% or 2% of the total capital invested. In addition to that, 40% of people in account-based pensions are drawing the minimum in our product set. So that, to me, talks to, well, perhaps they are prudently managing their money, even though they can withdraw it and go and spend it, they're not. And if I match that with the anecdotes I get from the advice businesses that we run, we have 1,800 planners across a number of different types of cohorts of retirees. It's rare that a retiree will come in and say that I want to diminish my capital so I can go on the pension. They want to make sure their capital lasts for them and is managed prudently. So they want a mix of products and services that they can do that with to match their budgets. So ultimately, there are various products that can do that. Account-based pension, I think, is going to be the mainstay of this for many, many years to come. That's not to say there's not room to improve on the annuity side of the equation, and there are certain efforts we can make there. But I just wanted to bring people's attention back to the value of account-based pensions and the players, what they're playing in today's retirement market. And ultimately, it's about advice and education and communication with the investors and to use a range of products to suit their needs in retirement.
Thank you, Brian. Tony.
When Barry asked me to speak about retirement today, I thought it was my retirement he wanted to talk about. But when I got clarity, he wanted me to spend a few minutes speaking about, I guess, Sun Super and how we handle retirement. We're an industry fund with about 1 million members, which is really a microcosm of the whole population. So we have people really of all ages, from 15-year-old apprentices in McDonald's through to people in their 80s in retirement. So it's very much, as I said, a microcosm of the whole country. However, we are still facing, like every other part of the country, a retirement bulge. And a lot of people, and of course most of the money in the fund is with the older generation. So we are facing, and we already have quite a number of people in retirement. But the whole question of defaults is a big issue for us, because most people are defaulted into a fund like ours when they join an employer. They don't choose to be in a fund. Therefore, when they get to retirement, they start to get interested, but at the same time, we don't have an army of financial planners advising them. So it's very much about having the right default mechanisms for people in our fund. Now, we do have a financial planning business which helps people into retirement, and we also have a product which is quite innovative called Today and Tomorrow, which has been very successful at getting people into retirement as well. And in fact, we did a lot of research on what do people want in retirement in terms of product, and not surprisingly, they wanted capital guarantee, indexation, access to the capital, all at very low fees. So that's pretty simple. In fact, we did a lot of research on this, and we really were keen to provide a guarantee to people on their income stream in retirement. The difficulty was we did a lot of market research, and what they wanted was quite surprising, and I'll give you a very brief summary of what they wanted. To make it very easy to understand, we use an example of a person with $500,000 and we would guarantee them 5% a year forever, $25,000 a year forever. And they could invest that in the market, you know, obviously a limit on how much could be in equities, but it could go up, 25,000 could go up if the market did well, but never drop below 25,000. When we explained that to people, and it only cost you an extra 0.5% on the fee for the guarantee. So we kept it real simple. This is proof of concept. The first question every customer asked was, is my capital guaranteed? So when we said, no, but it doesn't matter because your income's guaranteed, immediately there was a turn off. So the concept of guarantees is in Australia is very much linked in with a capital guarantee. There's very little comprehension that capital is only there for one purpose, which is to generate income. The whole focus is on capital guarantee. Now, I say that because one of the challenges, while we're very happy with the product we have today, one of the challenges, I think, is it's not the ultimate answer. We do think there's a better product. We haven't got it yet. We don't think anybody has it yet. But we are continuing our research in that area. The real conflict, I suppose, and as actors, as you all know that, that the, you know, we have to allow for so much improvement in longevity in making assumptions about guarantees that the cost of it is more than people think it's worth. And getting that balance right has really been the challenge. Having said that, this is a global challenge, as we all know, and certainly in speaking to funds overseas like ours, like Canada, US and UK, for example, they all have the same problem in that those that have annuities are finding they're unsustainable. The defined benefit plan contributions are too high. However, you know, people are used to having defined benefits, so they don't want defined contribution. And of course, everybody who comes to Australia tells us that our system is unsustainable because people want annuities in retirement. And we say your system is unsustainable because you can't afford the promise you have for people at the moment. So for us, I suppose where we're at in the cycle, we're lucky in that we're still early in the cycle given the demographic mix of our membership. But we don't believe that the answer is there yet. We do have, as I said, a good product. And we believe what people want in retirement and what will happen, I think, has to happen is we will have to break down our retirement assets into the capital and the income stream. And we'll have to be able to advise our members really how much of the capital which they have how much income has been generated from the capital which they have in the fund. So, for example, if we have a mix of property and infrastructure, for example, and equities, we'll need to be able to report on the income stream which they're generating, which is really what people should be interested in retirement, whereas the capital values may move around in much the same way as equities do. So at this stage, as I said, we think there's a lot of work to be done to fix this. We don't believe life annuities are the answer because, as we all know, we're going to live till 120, if not 150. And nobody, no actuary in this room knows how to price that kind of guarantee. So we don't think life annuities are the answer. Neither do we think term annuities are the answer because term annuities have a massive reinvestment risk. While it may look terrific today that you're getting 10% on your term deposit, which people were in 1990, when your 5 years is up and you have to reinvest and you're only getting 5%, well then your lifestyle in effect has to take a big hit. So we really don't think term annuities are the answer. We don't think life annuities are the answer. So we believe the answer really lies in an income stream where we can build in some kind of security for people or better reporting for people so they really understand the difference between what the capital is for, which is genuine income, but more importantly, what income is your capital generating, and that's what you should be basing your lifestyle on.
Thank you, Tony. Mark.
Hello?
Yep.
Thanks, Barry. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. It's interesting when we had the prep for this, I had a brief conversation with Barry, and he said, can you bring a global perspective to this? And I don't know if that's because I'm American or because I've had the challenge or good fortune to work here in Oceania. I've worked in Europe. I've worked in the U.S. But there is a change coming, and I would term it more of a tide than a tsunami. I think the reason for that is I think we actually have a great opportunity to plan for the changes coming in the demographics of people out there. Everyone seems to be in somewhat of a panic that everyone is living longer and we can't fund the retirement. But I do think we have enough time to do it. And a lot of what Tony was saying, I think, points to the fact that it's going to really take creativity in that there's not one solution that's going to solve it for everyone. And if I look at some of my experiences dealing with financial services companies in Europe and the U.S., which were probably a bit more on the forefront in developing retirement products, as Tony said, a lot of them didn't do too well. And they ran into challenges for that because they were making guarantees they couldn't back up. And I think that was less of a function of a fundamental problem with the product and more of a function of really an arms race of the marketing side of the business when times are very, very good. And all of a sudden it was at anything you could do to beat the competitor. And there's a number of folks, companies in the U.S. that are no longer in that business. You know, my company, MetLife, we're actually the largest in that business. We're still in it. But, you know, I would definitely say that the types of guarantees that people are making in the future are going to be probably not as generous as they were in the past. And that's a function of where we are in an interest rate environment, where we are in the volatility of equities, and just the realities of the markets today. I think what we have here in Australia is we have a very unique situation in that we've got a superannuation system second to none in the country. So we've really, really nailed the accumulation side of the business. And we've got a changing demographic of people that do need planning for retirement. So whether it's, you know, through Brian's advisors and you know, having diversified portfolios that can have a variety of different products in it, whether it's you know, guaranteed pensions or non-guaranteed pensions through a super fund, or whether it's property, whatever it is, I do think that there is going to be a place for products that are designed for the needs of the customer from the ground up that do focus on guaranteed income, because I do think there is going to be a place for guaranteed income in some of the demographic out there. I do agree with Tony that there's a segment of the population that is more interested in guarantee of capital than guarantee of income, and we've done our own research on that, and you know, it would hold true with some of the things that Tony said. But I think the biggest opportunity we have is to really learn from some of the mistakes that have been made around the world and take a from scratch really opportunity and build something designed around the true needs of the customer that can last regardless of what the markets do. And I do think that's possible, and I do think it can be priced appropriately, and I do think it can be delivered to the Australian population. We just have to take the time and effort to do it. And again, thank God, you know, a lot of other countries have made a lot of mistakes, because hopefully we can avoid making those same mistakes.
Thank you. Richard?
Thanks, Barry. Thanks also to Melinda and David and the Institute for the opportunity to talk with you today. you know, I'd like to echo Mark's comments around the observation that there's no one solution to this whole problem, that in the end we need to end up with a portfolio, both in a product sense but also in a solution sense. I would argue we currently have a portfolio which is probably too weighted towards an over-equitised model and one which is overly reliant on allocated pensions. But that's not to say that there is no place for allocated pensions. There's a massive place for allocated pensions. I think the problem with any debate in these areas, particularly one which is often waged in through media relations departments, is that they tend to become polarised, whether that's equities versus bonds, which tends to become or degenerate down to a one-dimensional argument over which returned more over the last 30 years, bonds or equities, or whether it's annuities versus allocated pensions. It seems to be that one must prevail over the other, and we must have one answer, or at least that's what the media would have us believe. And then perhaps more controversially still, this idea of compulsion versus liberty and choice. You know, does the free market work perfectly? Or is there some room for, I suppose, intelligent default setting, as Tony was alluding to? I suppose today, in dealing with some of those, I'd like to start with the premise that our system would be better and deliver better retirement income outcomes, results, if there was a greater availability and uptake of guaranteed income products offered by APRA-regulated life insurance companies. And there's two, I suppose, there's two steps to that argument. The first one, it feels like we're kind of winning, and the second one, it feels like there's some distance to travel still. The first step is that an acceptance that there is room for a more defensive asset allocation as our retirees and baby boomers in particular migrate from the accumulation stage into retirement. I think there is a growing recognition and awareness that retirement, in terms of risk tolerance for things like market risk, longevity risk and inflation risk is fundamentally different in retirement relative to where it is in the US, relative to where it is in accumulation. And that's supported by, you know, a number of arguments and some interesting studies, including one out of the United States recently, sponsored by one of the peak bodies for retirees there, which found that in retirement, risk aversion levels among retirees are 10 times what they are in accumulation. And that sits on top of the observations that many of us have made around market risk, being that there are massive problems with averages. You can't rely on average returns no matter how long your measurement period, because it's not the average return that a particular retiree needs to live on, it's the specific sequence that he lives through. And of course, if he incurs losses into his investment portfolio early in the piece severe enough, those together with the capital draws he needs to fund his own retirement can leave his pension so severely impaired that it can't recover to deliver a long enough retirement. Likewise, longevity, it's easy to get caught up in what is the correct mortality improvement number, and this is one audience that you can use that expression with without it falling on somewhat glazed eyes. But the debate is not about whether the life expectancy for a male is 90 and 92 for a female versus whatever the 2007 tables tell us at the moment. The debate is around how appropriate it is for an individual retiree to take his risk relative to that average. You know, the reality is that we don't know how long we as individuals are going to live. Is it going to be 10 years short of the 90, or is it going to be 10 years longer than the 90? Likewise, inflation, it's not so much an argument around whether the prolific money presses rolling in the United States and in Europe at the moment will spark a global inflation glut. It's more about the issue that, well, at 2.5% inflation, a dollar today is only worth 50 cents in 15 years' time, whereas at 10% inflation, it's worth more like 5 cents. The issue is we don't know what inflation is going to be, and our retirees need to protect themselves to some degree against those inflation outcomes. So I think it's fair to say that on top of the OECD observations that Australia has the most equitised retirement system in the world, given its youth, that's somewhat understandable. We have relatively few retirees in the system until recently. Now that that's changing, and given the lessons we've learned through the GFC, I think it's reasonable to accept or to put forward that most people accept we need to be a little more defensive. Step two in the argument, though, of advocating a greater uptake and availability of guaranteed income streams is the notion that the best form of defensive assets is at least to some degree in the form of an annuity or a guaranteed income stream which provides known inflation-linked income for life. And there are many dimensions on which the argument rolls as to whether that's an appropriate outcome or not. Some of the arguments revolve around how expensive or otherwise annuities are. Some of them revolve around counterparty risk and whether or not they are as safe as they purport to be. Dealing, and I think those are very important dimensions for the argument. Dealing with the second, that of counterparty risk, I think there to a degree. There is an extent to which this debate becomes misguided. The reality is that in the same way that a bank offering deposits and lending money to businesses operates within a strict prudentially regulated environment, so too does a life office. In fact, the capital that a life insurance company has to hold in offering annuities is significantly more onerous than that of a bank offering term deposits, and it's also offered in it's also regulated in a mark-to-market sense environment, such that a policyholder, unlike a deposit holder of a bank, an annuity holder is uniquely able to know that at all times the assets of an APRA-regulated life company, even after a 1 in 200-year shock to the system, will have sufficient assets to support the promises it's made to its policyholders. And shouldn't that not be the case, should those capital buffers be ever violated to any degree, then our regulator APRA has the ability to appoint a judicial manager who can come in and sell any risk assets and replace them with risk-free assets sufficient to defuse those promises made to policyholders. So I think the notion that the notion that we need to treat annuities as a separate category is fair in the sense that it's APRA regulated and enjoys very significant capital buffers, and the notion that defensive assets are good but they need to be held directly by investors ignores the extent of that capital buffer that exists in the case of an APRA regulated life company. Turning now briefly, and I realise I'm probably overstaying my stretch here, to the question of return. One of the most misguided observations which comes up again and again in the media is that the problem with annuities is that they are too expensive. It is very misguided to describe modern annuities as too expensive. They offer returns which are competitive to term deposits in the shorter term, and over long terms are likely to beat parameters like or measures like the Morningstar Median Manager Bond Index if you're comparing it to fixed income funds. The guaranteed returns on term certain annuities are in the order of 150 basis points over the equivalent maturity in a government bond, and in lifetime annuities they benefit further from the concept of a mortality credit. Again, this room will understand that the uncertainty caused by one's own specific life expectancy relative to population averages, whilst a hindrance in planning one's own retirement risk, is actually a help for a life insurance company in pricing its product. The mortality credit that's created by that product creates a higher return for a lifetime annuity relative to a fixed-term annuity to the same maturity. And so I think from both a return perspective and from a risk perspective, there is a very valid role for guaranteed income streams offered by life companies. I think, again, on this issue of where the debate rests, a lot of people confuse the failure of European and US defined benefit schemes with the failure of guaranteed income more generally. The problem with defined benefit schemes is that in the cases where those benefit schemes are provided by either governments or corporate sponsors, the regulatory rules which govern prudence and capital adequacy are not correctly applied. In fact, the fact that British Airways is more of a massively leveraged hedge fund with a small airline business on the side is an outcome of a lack of prudential regulation within the UK system over many decades, not an outcome of a failure in the concept of guaranteed income. So I might leave it there today.
Thank you. A lot of what we're talking about is customer needs. And presumably each of your organisations has done research and you've talked about customer needs at the moment. Is there anything that you're expecting that's going to change dramatically in the next 20 years as far as what customer needs will be? So, for example, Mark, is there a country around the world that is 20 years ahead of us that have got different needs to what we have? And so if you can go first and I'll ask the others
after
that.
I don't know if I can name a country that's 20 years ahead of us right now, but I think it's no shock to anyone that what's changing most in terms of customer interaction is that interaction itself. It's the choice of how to get information, where to get information, when to get information. It's very much moving towards doing it on the customer's terms. So whether that's through an iPad app or just through your laptop, it doesn't really matter. The customer's becoming more educated. They do want to get information where they want to get it, when they want to get it. So I think that's just going to be table stakes going forward, is you've got to be able to contact the customer where they want. And I think that's even going to bear through to the advisor industry. I don't think the advisor industry is going away. I think there's a huge place for advice in the future. But I think advisors also are going to wrestle with how are their customers going to be wanting to deal with them. It may not be coming into the office and sitting down for a couple hours. So I think that's going to be the biggest changes, is that access to information. Because, and any 30-something out there, 25-year-old, 30-year-old, can get on Yahoo Finance and do their own stock screening and do their own fund screening and come up with what they think is a viable financial plan. And there's no shortage of tools out there to make you think you know what you're doing. So we as providers of product or providers of advice, I think, are going to have to be, very creative in how we continue to add value and provide that interaction.
And Brian, you've got a number of massive advice businesses as well as the funds management businesses. Well, I mean, how do you look at member needs going forward? Do you just really react? Are you a wholesaler that just reacts to what the advisor wants? Or do you proactively push your advisors in developing sort of products for members in 15, 20 years' time?
Yeah, Barry, I try not to look too far out because I think you're trying to predict the future, and that's very, very difficult. We try to focus on what's happening and look at being very fast to move, to adopt to trends if you see the trends emerge, because you can lock yourself into a course of action which could be very costly if you get it wrong. So I don't like to speculate too much in the future, but probably the short answer to that is just it's more of the same. We are going to see more people move into retirement. Probably the biggest question from a policy perspective is, can we afford the cost of the larger cohort of retirees versus people who are in the workforce? So the taxation structure will change, no doubt, right, in some shape or form. And I don't know how. You've just got to think that this luxury of having tax-free retirement income may not be around forever. And that's another issue that retirees grapple with, is the change we see. We've just seen another announcement, you know, last week around taxation on the accumulation side. So it's trying to be very specific about what you're seeing, what's in the marketplace, how's government policy formulating now to react to that, to create products now. Chris Cuff was big on this, and I used to, we learned a lot from Chris through how he used to talk about, you know, you head off in a direction, you think you know where you're going, and you check back all the time. If you try to go too far in advance, you can lock yourself into a course of action which is ultimately not right.
Yeah, okay. Tony, you run a mutual life company, mutual investment company. So you've got multiple generations of people there. I mean, to what extent do you look at what is happening 20 years out in the way you look at your products?
Well, we do a lot of market research of our members. We don't have intermediaries in the middle, so we have a very direct relationship. But I think one thing worth reflecting on was experience of overseas markets, because 10 years ago, I mean, reflecting on the global experience in Japan, they were selling variable annuities like hotcakes. I mean, Japan has a very low inflation environment, very low interest environment. And these were products imported from the US, and they were offering basically guaranteed return of capital after a fixed term of 5 years, 10 years, whatever, even 20 years. Sometimes 110% of capital was returned. And many of these products paid commission of 7% up front, and no interest rate. No, in effect, the interest rate was 0.1%. It was like selling hotcakes. I mean, the Japanese were just pouring into these products, and the biggest seller was Hartford Life. The second biggest seller was AIG. Now, today, Hartford Life has closed its business in Japan. I think you might have bought a big swag of it, Mark, somewhere in the world. They're trying to sell the rest of what they had in Japan. And these were selling like literally tens of billions of dollars of product every year. We all know what happened to AIG. So, you know, annuities and guarantees sound like, as I said, a silver bullet. Certainly they were for those people. So and everybody seems to think that they can find the magic bullet, but it's not that easy. In our case, you know, we do look to the future, Barry, because we are big believers in, trying to develop the right solutions rather than knee-jerk reaction to what customers want today. And I use that example of term deposits because, again, you know, 20 years ago when I was selling term annuities in the Commonwealth Bank, we were selling annuities at, you know, 8 or 9, 10%, which people loved. And then when they matured, the interest rate had dropped quite significantly. And, you know, people were basing their lifestyle on unrealistic expectations. So we do believe that, you know, we really have to, a trustee view on this. We really want to build sustainable income streams for our members and not just put out what the latest fad is, because that's going to get you sales. And that's probably where we're a bit different. Right. We're not just chasing sales. We really have a fiduciary duty to look after our members right through retirement. And we take that on as, in effect, a financial planner and a trustee and in effect, the member management managers. Yeah. We roll all those up into one, and we work very hard to get sustainable products and sustainable income streams into the future. Yeah. Because when we have a product, we know it's very easy to launch a new one. It's very hard to close it down. And you know, you see a lot of the industry has thousands of products with, you know, tiny amounts in them, and they can't close them.